This is Mae Brussel. This is KAZU-FM in Pacific Grove, California, and it's broadcast number 647. I can't believe it, April the 30th, 1984. That time is going away very fast, another month tucked away. Last week I mentioned that postage stamp, What's Past is Prologue, and asked you and several people about the quotation. I thought it was Shakespeare. I went down to L.A. and I asked my father, who's almost going to be 94, where that came from, and it took him about 1 minute, and he said The Tempest, and it was Shakespeare. So we got out The Tempest, and that quotation, What is it Past is Prologue. That is a stamp for the National Archives, but very pertinent to now, 1943 to 1984, or 1934, the year after Hitler came to power, and up to 1984, the National Archives. I'll make a few comments on the death of David Kennedy, because not too much, because what is there to say on this case, really? It's a tragedy, and the Kennedys will be followed with tragedy. I remember Richard Nixon on April the 16th, that was just a week and a few days before, asked on CBS television about the Kennedy mystique, and he was pretty callous, and he said, yes, they have it, but the direct quote was, the Kennedy mystique will last as long as one of them is living. So one less. Dick Nixon, that's one less. Playboy has a story this month, The Fall of the Young Kennedys. That, of course, the publications arrange these things 3 months in advance. Inside a Troubled American Dynasty. I saw this on the newsstand and just gasped, because it seems that Playboy has these cover stories simultaneously. I know with John Lennon, I believe it was John Belushi. Check out, if you have old Playboys, how many times they had a cover story, the exact time that a particular person in there was murdered at that time. As I say, 3 months ahead, the story is arranged, and it takes 2 months earlier to write it, but it falls just about at the same time. The London Times has a story, Kennedy's son, 28, found dead. A short article, it said, police would not say what caused his death, but there was no evidence of foul play. That's like the Dallas Police Department saying on national television that the evening after John Kennedy was murdered, that they don't have any physical evidence or hard evidence to link Lee Harvey Oswald to Kennedy's death, but they know that he is the one. You don't need the evidence as long as you know who did it. This boy has had since childhood, 15 years since his father died, has had a lot of problems. He has had a drug habit. He's tried to break it. He recently was enrolled at Harvard, and his ambition was to become a journalist. He was working for Atlantic Magazine, and, of course, you know the traces of cocaine and the Demerol, the traces, of course. And then it usually takes a few weeks to find what was in his body, the autopsy. I understand the family has asked for an autopsy. The person who supplied the particular cocaine has not been seen. I doubt if that person will ever appear, so we have no way of knowing whether there was a purposeful way of overdosing this and having him die from that. There's a lot of people on cocaine. I mention it over and over again. In the Fortune 500 or in the Forbes list of American industry or business, cocaine traffic is seventh between IBM, I think, and General Motors, the money from cocaine. And I take a lot of papers every day and get clippings for more, and I'm not aware of how many deaths there are from cocaine. Just the very famous happen to be able to die of the cocaine. The others take it every day and don't seem to have that kind of a demise. I don't think there are that many deaths. I may be wrong. Or maybe they don't get the publicity. I know one thing, that Senator Edward Kennedy has been very strong attacking the Central Intelligence Agency in the last 2 weeks. His uncle, he was on television, and I taped that the same time I taped the Nixon interview, attacking William Casey of the CIA for the mining of the harbor in Nicaragua. And in the New York Times, April 18th, there's a picture of Senator Edward Kennedy saying, look at transition fund urged in Meese inquiry. And he's asked the independent counsel to look into the federal tax laws regarding Edwin Meese and that transition foundation in 1980 and 81. He's been very vocal, not as a possible candidate, but as a person bucking the Ronald Reagan administration. You don't kill off all the Kennedys to get the vocal opponent, the kind they're getting out of Ted Kennedy, and he is visible in the media all the time, taking on Meese and Casey. And every death that happens takes a piece out of them and hurts them terribly. This was a sensitive boy who was very close to his father and shared a lot of things with his father. He never really got over the murder of Robert Kennedy. And so now when he's ready to return back to Harvard and finish his degree, he had almost finished it and go into journalism, his life is cut short. And I wonder if he would have done the kind of journalism that his father was doing in politics, where he was meeting with people of less privilege and so forth, and branch out and even maybe investigate someday the man who really murdered his father when Sirhan Sirhan took the rap. Our Monterey Herald had a large article last Sunday, a week ago Sunday, on George Seldes. Finally, a George Seldes. I never knew about him until Charles Spears and Art Cherry told me about George Seldes. He's 93 years old. He is a giant in terms of literature, getting books out and attacking the press. And I was happy to see that our local paper re-ran a story that was printed by William Cockerham on George Seldes. He was pushed to the back burner because he was exposing the nation's press, what is allegedly our free press system, and was filled with criticism. He had covered the Russian Revolution, the Spanish Civil War, and World War I, you can imagine, 93. He's still active. He lives in a town in Vermont. And if you want to write to him, Route 1, Windsor, Vermont, 05089. He's still alive. And if you ever want to be nice and feel in the mood to say thank you, George Seldes, you can write to him there. Route 1, Windsor, Vermont, 05089. And furthermore, you can buy his books at used bookstores, buy them, they're collector's items. I picked up another Sawdust Caesar. I was down in Los Angeles at a used bookstore. He wrote, "You can't print that. Can these things be? The World Panorama, the Vatican, Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, Iron, Blood, and Profit, Sawdust Caesar, Freedom of the Press, Lords of the Press, The Catholic Crisis, Witch Hunt, The Facts Are, Facts and Fascism, 1,000 Americans, The People Don't Know, Tell the Truth and Run, Great Quotations, and Never Tire of Protesting." That is a lifetime of work. He briefly was in the movie Reds. Warren Beatty just flashed a few people on the screen and didn't identify his face with his name. But this was a great person who began a little newspaper called In Fact. And Charles Spears in Texas bought the four volumes for me, so I have every publication. There's some very nice people who take these programs, the cassettes, and listen to World Watchers, who do supply me with these things that I couldn't afford otherwise, that I really treasure, articles and books and things that add to my library, and then I pass on to you. George Seldes is finally, in some way, written about, even in our Monterey Herald, but he is alive, and his work is invaluable. He didn't sit back and take the lies. You may see the duplicity in the news all the time and the hypocrisy. He never settled for that, and he was always exposing these things. So he's a very valuable person. There's several articles I want to update with you, share with you, that were in the London Times this past week. One has to do with a decision to ban the books on Banco Ambrosiano in Italy. This is April 24th, 1984. Book ban revives the P2 fear. The P2 fear is the infamous Masonic lodge that planned a coup in Italy and in European countries around the world. It was set up by Licio Gelli, who worked with Franco and then set up the equivalent of the Gestapo in Italy with the black shirts. And then when Italy collapsed, he worked with the Nazis. Then after the war, fled to Argentina and came back in the 1950s to begin fascism all over again. The P2 organization is alive and well, and this article said the decision by a Varese, V-A-R-E-S-E, court to block the order the confiscation of four current books about the collapse of Banco Ambrosiano on the grounds of alleged libel has dismayed the Italians. This step is without precedent, and it was taken at the request of a man who is on the lam, who's wanted for arrest, Mr. Umberto Orleani, O-R-L-O-N-A-N-I, who he has a Brazilian citizenship. There's a warrant out for his arrest regarding the failure of Italy's largest bank, and he worked and was close to Signor Licio Gelli, the head of the P2, who's also hiding and who was at Reagan's inauguration and close to him and the various fascist elements in our own government. Another article about the fugitive Rumasa Bank that's linked to Licio Gelli, the head of the Rumasa Bank, Rumasa organization, fled Spain. He was wanted on a missing $775 million that went into the Opus Dei. That is the far right-wing lay Catholic organization that funds fascist movements around the world. And Mr. Senor Mario Ruiz Mateos, M-A-T-E-O-S, set up the Rumasa Group with 645 companies and fled Spain because he was wanted for fraud, falsification of documents, and tax offenses. He was in England where they wouldn't extradite him to Madrid for these hearings and recently showed up in the United States. I'm sure he was meeting with Michael Ledeen and Ronald Reagan and William Casey and members of the Opus Dei and the Sovereign Military Order of Malta in the United States, such as William Simon and William Buckley and William Casey and William Clark and the heads of our Vernon Walters, the head of our CIA and our deepest, most hard right-wing intelligence operators working through every administration in full glow with Ronald Reagan in power. He came to the United States and stopped at Frankfurt on a stopover when there was information that he was there and he was held and arrested and they want him sent back to Madrid for trial to find out where this missing money goes. Now, speaking of the suppression of the books on Banco Ambrosiano, there's a very right-wing person. His name is Mr. Patterson. He has a newsletter that is very far right. He's challenging the government, but he's interested in the finances of this country, how the banks work. L.T. Patterson, home base, is Cincinnati and Basel, Switzerland. And he has a newsletter that comes out every month on various parts of our government, and he calls it a monthly lesson in criminal politics. They once wanted to give me some mailing list and information I could send my tapes to if I gave them the names of people that I knew from my friends and subscribers. And I said, I don't send off names like that and don't give your name to any single person. And I said, furthermore, I object to the fact that you don't go into, when you talk about finances, the Nugenhand Bank, the Banco Ambrosiano, the fascist money that is cycled with mafia and drugs, and you avoid those questions. So now it's interesting, with his latest newsletter, he's advertising to sell the book by Penny Lerneau in Banks We Trust. And he has a brochure here, you can call a toll-free number. Finally, an expose of New York bank connections with drugs. He doesn't say all the religious connections, but he's advertising the book. And once you read it, you can figure a lot out for yourself. It's not only New York drugs, there's Australian, New York banks, there's Australian, and you know, banks all over the world, and Banco Ambrosiano. But he is advertising the book as part of his newsletter, as part of a study of financial activity going on. So that's a good step forward in order to solve what is happening to banks in every country of the world and the economy of these countries. Eventually, you have to come together with the Nazi drug dealing combine plus the United States intelligence agencies. There's no other way to save the economy or the banks if you don't address yourself to these particular things. You can avoid it all you want, but even the Wall Street Journal has good articles on these subjects, because you can't talk about the economic health of this country without knowing where the money's going out of the country and how it's being recycled into drugs and weapons. There was another short article in the Wall Street Journal about the Vatican Bank, and the Italian government is closing in on the Vatican now because, again, they lost hundreds of millions of dollars that went to Licio Gelli down to Argentina just as this money was sent out of Spain. this huge amount of hundreds of millions out of Spain. It doesn't serve the people in Spain. This article says Vatican Bank gets a notice of a liability in the Ambrosiona case. Now, I haven't studied that much about the Vatican banks in the past, just currently in the last years, but I bet this is the first time that the Italian government said they may have an attachment to the Vatican property. Can you see Italy coming in and taking the property? This is from Milan. The judges investigating the collapse of Italy's largest bank, the Banco Ambrosiano, served a notice of civil liability. Civil. You know, they changed the law so that they're now responsible for that. For the responsibility against the Vatican Bank, it's called La Opere di Religione, O-P-E-R-E, then small d-I, religion, just like it sounds, religion with an E on it. The I-O-R-O-I-R is called the shortcut. The court sources said the notices were served by a judge and that it's aimed at clearing the way for action against the IOR property if they don't pay their money to Italy and the investors. Remember, a few weeks ago, they were going to settle a few hundred million, pay $250 million on a $500 million settlement, put down $250. Well, they said they would, and they reneged on that. So they have already served Archbishop Paul Marcinkus, the head of the Vatican Bank, and Luigi Manini and Pellegrino de Strobel, S-T-R-O-B-E-L. The senior officials of the bank. Now Italy's getting mean and says, look, we'll come and attach to the Vatican. And you see Italy coming and saying, you owe us this money. I think we'll take over the Vatican and the Italian government move in. I don't think it'll be that bad, but they've served papers and they're getting angry that the money has been held up. Now, there was a reverse in the news that I do want to mention because it's an interesting reverse. Usually the people I talk about are very consistent in the way they meet or act, and there aren't too many contradictions. And when there are contradictions, trouble follows, and I'm wondering about this particular news story. I mentioned the group of very prominent people, including Robert Keith Gray, who I'm going to do more about in a few minutes, working to get these charges off of Reverend Moon. He was convicted in 1982 of tax fraud, obstruction of justice, false statement charges, and he was sentenced to 18 months in prison and a $25,000 fine. Now, Moon has a lot of wealthy people like Mr. Sasakawa that we've talked about and the Korean CIA and our CIA. He's got a lot of heavyweights behind him, all the intelligence community trying to keep him out of jail. But Ronald Reagan's administration, for some reason, and this is from the Washington Post, opposes the review of Moon's case. Now, William French Smith has resigned, and he's going to leave as soon as the Meese thing is over if he doesn't sink with it. And Edwin Meese is holding on, trying to keep his appointment, which I doubt will go through. But this gang had worked so closely with the Korean CIA and Reverend Moon that it's particularly interesting what the Justice Department does when Smith and Meese get locked horns and they're under their own problems. The underlings or somebody in the Justice Department doesn't want to let him off the case. It says the Reagan administration yesterday urged the Supreme Court not to review the federal tax fraud of Reverend Moon. The government took this action despite unusually intense lobbying by various religious and civil liberties organizations. And I read you those heavyweights. They contend the case raises fundamental issues of religious freedom. Now, the Justice Department said that there's little significance in what they're saying, that the people that want him out have not read the conviction papers. They said this conviction was supported by proof of massive and undisputed effort to deceive the tax authorities, by documented fabrications, by false explanations and perjury. He didn't cooperate and he lied and he changed the documents. And they said contrary to what these various people are saying, there's no reason in a court of law to let Reverend Moon out. As I say, he was convicted of these various charges. I can't see Moon out. I could see Reagan shot before I see Moon out, in jail rather. This is an interesting thing because he's so important with the Korean airline story and the, if it was a provocateur situation, and he knows so much and his mentor is making so many gifts around this country. And there's so much high influence, it would be very hard to see how they would put him in jail. It's hard to believe. We saw John Mitchell, an attorney general, but this is a little different. I mean, this guy knows where the bodies are buried. And the Ronald Reagan administration, the justice, are opposing this no matter what kind of lobbying. So I'm wondering if it can be used just as, say, John Kennedy went through with the Bay of Pigs invasion to a certain point. He was told it had to be done. It was arranged before he was president. He pulled back and took the responsibility, and then the anti-Castro Cubans were part of a Defense Department and high-level plan to murder John Kennedy, and the Bay of Pigs became one of the modus operandi for the adrenaline of the really heavy hit guys who could get in there and do it and be angry. So I'm wondering if this isn't some kind of a setup. Remember, Reagan was shot once, as was the Pope, and by them turning Moon down, I wonder if this administration turned him down. That literally makes Ronald Reagan a target, if you know the way these people have operated before, and I just don't believe there would be any hesitation to get one of these brainwashed zombies from South Korea, because that's where they were hatched from. This was one of the great places of South Korea, the training in Tokyo and South Korea, and hatch a zombie who gets mad because their reverend had to go to jail. So we'll watch that story, but it was a change in the administration that's gone along with every fascist under the sun, and certainly with elections coming up and money needed always by, they never have enough. Moon has the money, and so it's interesting. I just think it's worth noting and sharing with you to see what happens. The Los Angeles Herald has a story this week. Noguchi says he'll be the official coroner of the Olympics. I couldn't believe it. After detailing last week and the weeks before the potential for violence with the Alpha 66 and the YAF and the Moonies with their CARP organization, I'll be doing more on that in the violent street politics. And see, there's a group that the Moonies have set up who may not like their god and leader. That brings in the El Salvadorians and the Nicaraguans and the far right wing from the military dictatorships with a death squad. So if their god isn't out of jail, we have that organization that is really armed for violence. Well, Mr. Noguchi wants to be the official coroner. If you have the Hells Angels carrying the torch along with Michael Reagan and all these groups with a past history of violence coming into Los Angeles, what better job than old Noguchi? And he wants his job back. He claims that he was fired because of the pressure on him because of his tell-it-like-it-is comments about celebrities and celebrity deaths. The one celebrity that he really told it like it was Robert Kennedy, and his new book, Coroner, tells about the second gun and the burns and the possibility, or even comes out and says that there was a second gun in the Ambassador Hotel and Sirhan wasn't in that position and didn't do it. So what a better person with all the other murders that were covered up in Los Angeles to have old Noguchi back as the official coroner. He doesn't say how many are going to be killed, whether they'll be bunches or singles, but it's interesting that he's going to be the official coroner in Los Angeles. Now usually I begin the program with what happened a year ago tonight, but I'm putting it in the middle of this particular broadcast for a reason. Last year, broadcast number 595, that was May the 2nd, 1983, I was talking about the plot to kill the Pope and the links of the right-wing arms and drugs and assassination teams as against Mr. Aja, Mehmet Aja, who worked with the neo-Nazis and the Nazis, and the involvement of people other than the Bulgarian propaganda to try to pass it off into Eastern Europe that they're Antichrist and tried to kill the Pope. I was talking about that, and I was also talking about primary witnesses to the case of Edwin Wilson of the CIA, who had been arrested, and how many had been murdered in a short time span. Last year, there was a rash of murders, 1983, to kill the witnesses of Mr. Wilson of the CIA, who worked with Frank Turpel and Gary Corkula. Now, those names are important for news stories this past week that broke, and because their names are so important, their witnesses, the people they worked with, had to be murdered. A great deal of them that are high up, the highest up, had to be murdered to break the connecting links with the very tall echelon of the National Security Agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency, and the CIA. Waldo Duberstein was murdered and shot. That was just a year ago. in April, and he was high up with the Defense Intelligence Agency. He was a former Defense Department intelligence agent who was shot, and he was working with Edwin Wilson and Frank Turple. Earlier, Kevin Mulcahy was shot. He had blown the story on Edwin Wilson and Frank Turple and the CIA and their connections to the Office of Navy Intelligence. And that is important because I'm going to Robert Keith Gray for the second half of this broadcast. Kevin Mulcahy was blown away just before he was to testify on Edwin Wilson's case. And Rafael Villaverde had been killed on a yacht in the fall of 82. He worked with the CIA and the drugs and the gun running. Luke Thompson, who worked, a former Green Beret who worked with Wilson and Turple, was afraid of his life. Last year, we haven't heard a thing about him or where he is. William Russell Cranford was shot twice to death in Florida, and this was only written up in a rare Winston-Salem Journal. He was 20 years in Army Special Forces, Army Intelligence, and he worked with Edwin Wilson in Ecuador and in North Carolina transporting guns, some of the weapons for them, for the CIA terrorism came out of North Carolina. And that comes up again, another story we'll share. Ricardo Morales was gunned down in Miami. He was part of the Condor team that Jack Anderson's written about. This was the assassination teams. Incidentally, Otto Scorzeni's group at the Battle of the Bulge was called the Condor, the hit teams, and then they moved down to Argentina and Chile. And Morales was part of that with Edwin Wilson and Frank Turple and the Bay of Pigs, and bragged about mass murders in the Congo and worked for the CIA. So he was an important witness that was murdered. So Mr. Duberstein, he was with the CIA from 1947 to 1971, then Defense Intelligence Agency. That's where Fritz Kramer was the head of Defense Intelligence Agency. That's the mentor of Henry Kissinger and the partner now of Daniel Graham of High Frontier. Sometimes I'll remind you of these names because there are a lot of names. But a year ago, this week, the latest was Mr. Duberstein of the Defense Intelligence Agency, who had been murdered. And then also I talked that evening about Hitler's diary and the Waffen-SS. And, of course, you know that there was a reunion just a couple of weeks ago, and we might have mentioned it, of the Waffen-SS, Hitler's special group of the Death's Head who swore to keep the Reich going 1,000 years. Incidentally, when they met about 3 weeks ago in Germany, there weren't 10 or 12 survivors. In case you have any question about that, there were over, I think it was 800 that attended the meeting. Now, that doesn't count the sons and daughters. Some of them, like Martin Bormann, had huge families. They were prolific, and they adopted children, and they took some of these Liebersborn, these test tube babies, and raised them with the Gestapo. So we're talking about 800 families. These were just the males that were there, not the daughters or the sons or where they went. 800 could produce, you know, easily 24 or 3,600 offspring of the Waffen-SS. And the money that was missing, that was paid for Hitler's diary, goes to them because they're pretty hungry and they needed money. And the story is that the money that went from the Hitler diary that was paid to expose that or to sell it to the papers went to members of the Waffen-SS. So last year at this time, I was talking about the necessity to murder so many primary witnesses. And how important were Wilson and Turple? Were they just renegades doing it on their own? Of course not, because there's no way that you would kill that many people if they weren't important. Now, I'll begin. We have about 1 minute on for the first half of the program. We'll begin with an article that came out in Time magazine last week, April the 30th, 1984. A very important story about Robert Gray. And I want you to remember his name, Robert Keith Gray, and there's a picture of him, so you can either get your old time out, maybe you've read it, or go to the library and photocopy it, because I'll be using his name maybe every week for the next 20 weeks. Robert Mullen Associates was a public relations office in Washington at the time of the Watergate arrest, where E. Howard Hunt and James McCord and G. Gordon Liddy and the whole Water gang worked. This was their headquarters, and they were public relations offices for the CIA, for Howard Hughes, for members of the Democratic Party that worked with them that were spies on the Democrats. And this was the big headquarters, the international headquarters, for that team. Now, after Mullen and company was exposed at the time of Watergate, it seems that, or because the election's coming up in 1981, Robert Keith Gray, part of all the past administrations, opened up his own PR office, which seems to be doing the role that the Mullen Associates did for Richard Nixon's election. We'll take a one-minute break and then get on to Robert Gray, because, as I say, his name is very important, and you do have a rare opportunity to go to the library and get that article on him and see his picture, because even in that one article, they hit a lot of subjects that are important about him.